Good afternoon. So last time we started by covering the calling convention that Linux uses on 64-bit x86 systems. You mentioned that generally calling conventions are this sort of agreement between function writers and function users, and often function writers also use other functions. And it's not set by the hardware, right? The hardware doesn't say where you put arguments. It provides you with some instructions for helping calling functions, which might make you make different decisions. But you know, this is something where people like compiler writers and operating system writers need to choose. And we saw that there were certain arguments for, certain registers for the return value. I see I did one of those. And that we have this idea of, well, we can have a function with lots of arguments, the overflow goes on the stack. And besides deciding how we pass values to and from functions, we also need to figure out, well, what do we do about values that we change in registers? Because registers, you know, that are used in a function are the same registers that are used after the function returns. So how do you make that work? And what we do is we divide up the registers into sort of two groups. We have registers where the function is responsible for setting the register back if it changes, which we call callee saved, and ones which are caller saved, where the function doesn't need to do anything special if it uses them, which means that if you're using those registers and you call a function, you have to assume they're changed, even though maybe the function doesn't actually use them. You have to assume the worst, because some version of that function might use that register. After talking about the calling convention, we looked at condition code. So as we typically teach how we do conditionals in assembly in 2150, it looks like, oh, you have this compare followed by a conditional jump instruction. And this requires some extra thinking about how that works, because somehow the information needs to get from the compare instruction to the conditional jump instruction. And we said that the way we're going to do that is by having these special registers we call a condition code that store information about the result of the last arithmetic. And we mentioned we had two particular bits of information that were kind of most important, the zero flag ZF and the sign flag SF. And it was the result of last arithmetic, because even though it wouldn't be a crazy decision to say that these condition codes were only set by compare, the designers of x86 decided that basically all the arithmetic instructions are going to set them based on whatever the result is. And then the jump instructions are going to be named after what the compare instruction would do. So they're named after what happens when you subtract two values and what that value you get means and how it reflects with the condition code. So for example, when we subtract two values and get zero, it means they're equal. So jump if equal actually checks whether the last arithmetic result was zero. After looking at condition codes, we looked at mapping C to assembly, which I think you did some version of in 2150. I mentioned sort of the strategy I like using is I don't go directly from C to assembly. I first go to this sort of C with go-tos, because after I do that, all the control flow is things there. I can look at each line of code and basically write assembly instructions pretty directly. And finally, we had a very brief mention of, well, not all C maps so easily to assembly, and switches were an example where it wasn't actually obvious what assembly to produce. And compilers, in fact, have a whole bunch of different strategies they use for switches, and you can imagine the same sort of thing might come up in other constructions that are sort of higher level you see in other languages. So you could like turn switches into a bunch of if-thens, you could do a binary search, or you could do this jump table strategy, which where you have an array of locations of the cases and you look up in that array. So before I move on, questions about these topics we covered last time? Okay, so for today, we're going to first look at, well, we know about writing assembly, And we have some sort of vague idea that it turns into machine code, but there's some extra steps as far as, well, what does it mean to make an executable file from an assembly program? Like, there's something we're going to miss when we talk about a typical assembly program, because it's actually incomplete. If you think of, like, writing hello world in C, you probably call a function to print something. Where is that function? You probably don't put it in your assembly file. So we'll look at that. And to talk about this, we should first talk about, well, what happens when we actually load a program? And typically, we have some conventional memory layout. So this is the, maybe not the memory layout you see in, like, a debugger, but this is sort of the conventional memory layout that 64-bit Linux has used for a while. It's not always what's used. And what they do here is we have some part of the memory at the top, which is used by the OS. We have our stack. This is where we store things that are pushed and popped, including return addresses. And when we save registers, they typically save them here. And on x86, the stack grows down, meaning towards lower addresses, which just means that when you want to add something to the stack, you have your stack pointer that points to the next place you add, and you subtract from it. And this stack is going to contain information about the functions being called. So separately, we have this region I label as the heap and other dynamic memory. So this is where we'll keep things that are malloced or nude and other stuff that we create as the program is running. Below that, we have these two regions, writable data. So that's global variables where we might have an initial value we load when we start the program, and the code and constants of the programs. This is where that machine code that our assembly turns into, it actually is, along with constant values. Now, something you might notice about this diagram is that there's these holes. There's these spaces in between this stuff. And question of, like, how does that work? So much, much later in the semester, we're going to talk about virtual memory, which is a way that the operating system can set addresses that the program can see that aren't the real addresses. There's going to be some mapping done so that when the program accesses part of its stack, it's going to use a different location. And this means that we aren't wasting a huge amount of space. Because from this diagram, it looks like, gosh, there's this huge region of memory that you're just wasting. But it turns out that what we're doing instead is we're having the OS set up a mapping from the addresses the program tries to use to the real addresses, the ones that would go out on that memory bus we talked about, such that these empty spaces just don't have a mapping. They aren't actually using memory at all. And also, you'll notice that there's a space I labeled as used by the OS. So the OS, for reasons we'll talk about much later in the semester, reserves part of the addresses the program can use for its own use. And that appears as one of these holes, but it's actually used internally by the OS in some useful way. So questions about what I've shown so far? So this part here, where we have our global variables with some initial value and our code and related constants, this is loaded from the executable file. And ideally, we'd like it to be the case that we have an executable file on disk and we just copy it into this part of memory, and that's starting a program. We'll copy it there and we jump there. That's what we'd like loading a program to be like. So we're going to talk about how we get from assembly to that. And there's going to be a bit of extra work because we can't just translate instruction by instruction with a typical assembly program. We'll see why in a bit. And we're going to think about this in terms of, like, let's starting with C. So if we start with C, we have a program like here, my Hello World program. And you may remember from 2150, you take this Hello World program, you compile it into assembly. You take that assembly, convert it into an object file, and then that object file turns into an executable. And sometimes you'll use one command which does all multiple of these steps. So if you, like, use the GCC command that produces an executable directly. It just does all those steps for you instead of you doing them one by one. But you've, I believe, learned that there's this way, this process. And the reason we have this extra object file step is because, well, we can combine multiple C files together in what we call linking when we make an executable. And in fact, this is going to happen in this case. So here, I use this function printf. And you might say, oh, okay, well, that function is defined in standard io.h. So when the C compiler produces the assembly file, it's going to be in there. And that's a good guess. That would make sense. That's not what happens. If you look in the assembly file, you won't see any of the code for printf. And if you look in standard io.h, what you'll likely see is just a declaration of printf, something similar to this. And so all the compiler knows is somewhere there's a function called printf. It returns an int. It takes a character pointer and some other arguments. And that's how the compiler is generating its assembly. It doesn't actually know what the implementation of printf looks like. So its assembly is just saying, call this function called printf that's defined somewhere, you know, and I've done the work to make its arguments work. So your question might be, well, how does my executable how is it able to call printf? Like, the code has to be loaded when the executable runs. So what we can do is we can have the object file, which was generated from the C code for printf, be also included in our executable. And compilers generally will do this for parts of the standard library. They'll somehow include them in your executable without you asking, unless you explicitly tell them, no, I don't want printf and all those things. Don't include them in my executable. Otherwise, it will try to add them in. I mentioned, so you've probably seen these commands or the version of these commands with Clang. So we have the compile, assemble, and link steps, and most commonly you'll do some combination of them, which still usually actually involves the intermediate files. So for example, in this last command here, still generates an object file that gets combined with the object files related to standard library stuff. It's just that those are generated in a temporary directory and then thrown away. Okay, so questions about this process before we look at what's actually in an object file to make this work? Okay. So I'm going to go through what's in these files. I'm going to use an example here that are Hello World. I'm using puts to make things as simple as possible. So I took this hello.c, and I compile it, and I get an assembly file like this. So there's some things going on in this assembly file I'm going to talk about, because you might say, wait, this isn't how I expected this to be translated. So one thing you'll notice immediately is that we've marked part of this assembly file as text and part of it as data. So text is an old word for code. I don't know why they use it, but they do. And this divides it up into two pieces, and these will go into different parts of the executable later, and therefore will be separated when we make our object file. You may also notice that we have this code here that the compiler generated for me, which subtracts 8 from the stack pointer and then adds 8. You might say, gosh, this compiler's stupid. Why is it wasting its time doing that? And it turns out that this is required because one of the things that the Linux calling convention says is that when you call a function, the stack pointer has to be a multiple of 16. And when you run a call instruction, it pushes 8 bytes on the stack, so the stack pointer will not be a multiple of 16, so this is fixing that. And this is something the compiler does. It also might explain some code you might have seen in the bomb lab. Also, there's this XOR. So this is a way of setting EAX to 0. You might say, why didn't they use a move instruction? because this instruction is slightly shorter in machine code. So that's our assembly code here. Now, to make an object file from this, we want to translate the assembly instructions here and the data into bytes, the sort of bytes that we're going to eventually load into memory. So we'll go through these instructions, write them out as bytes, as machine code. We're not going to go over how real x86 machine code works, but this is what you get, with a caveat we'll talk about in a sec. And also the data gets translated. And here I'm writing these out as hexadecimal so we can read them easily and to make everything consistent. But in a typical object file, well, we don't want to actually waste space when you're like compiling a big application by writing everything out in hexadecimal and waste time by converting from hexadecimal to actual bytes and back. So they'll be actually in bytes in a binary format, and you'd have to use some tool to figure out what the bytes are. In fact, on Linux, the tool you use for that is called objdump, objdump. So we have these generated bytes, and different parts of this correspond to different parts of our assembly. So for example, this subtract instruction turns into these 4 bytes of machine code in x86-64, and our move instruction to RDI turns into this byte BF followed by the address to move. And you may notice that this generated code for the address to move, this L string, this reference to this string, it's put zeros. And you might say, that seems wrong, and it is wrong. But the problem is, we don't know where the string's going to end up in memory yet. We don't know how the executable is going to look, what else is going to be there, what memory location is going to be chosen. So we just leave it as a placeholder. And we're going to have to do something about that later because, well, when we run the executable, it better not be zeros, right? This string is not going to be located at address zero. It's going to be somewhere else. We have to have that filled in. And similarly, we have this call. So the call instruction starts with this byte EA and then has the offset to get to the function we're calling. And, well, we don't even see puts in this assembly file. It must be somewhere else. We don't know it. Where its code is yet, we don't even have its code. So we're going to leave a placeholder there, and we'll fix it later. Now, these two placeholders we left, we need to remember that they were there and write a note for later so that when we make the executable, we actually fill them in. And these notes are called relocations. So along with the actual machine code and data, we're going to have this table of placeholders that we need to fill in later. So here we'll say, okay, at index 5 of the text segment, there are some bytes that you need to replace with wherever the data segment ends up in memory. And at index 10 of the text segments, there are some bytes you need to replace with the location of puts in memory. And this is something you need to do to make this run in the executable. So there's one other thing we're going to need to write down to make an executable later on. So one piece of information that's in this assembly file that we need later on, and that's where main is, right? Something needs to start at main. And typically, when you write main in C, there's actually some standard library code that calls main. And so it needs to be able to call it from elsewhere. And to make this work, well, we need to know where main is. So we're going to have another table called the symbol table, which is going to have an entry for all the labels that could be used from elsewhere. And so it's going to say, you know, main, it's 0 bytes into the text segment of this object file. So when you're trying to figure out a call to main from elsewhere, from the standard library, you look at this table to figure out where that ended up. Questions about the contents I've shown of our object file? Yes?
Hello.s, is there a reason why the EAX register uses it like the other return registers, like REX?
The question is there a reason why EAX is used here instead of REX? Yes, because it makes for a slightly shorter assembly. Yes. The question is, why was RSP not a multiple of 16 when main is entered? So when main is, when the call instruction that calls main is executed, RSP is a multiple of 16. But the call instruction pushes 8 bytes onto the stack, which means we subtract 8 from RSP, so RSP becomes no longer a multiple of 18. 16. Yes, I mean 16 every time. And you might say, maybe this wasn't the best calling convention design, but it's what they do. Yeah?
So in the object file, those two bottom sections, would those be, are those just implicit that you're writing there, or are those actual bytes that exist in the file?
So the question is, do we need to store the relocations in the symbol table? Yes, because if this needs to be a file, you can like copy around, and it needs to still work. It needs to have all that info. So it's going to be actually written in there. And so you can look at the .o files with an appropriate tool, like ObjectDump, and you'll get these listings. And I have my slide. So for example, you know, if you pass the appropriate options to ObjectDump, you'll like get an actual list of relocations, which is in a much more complicated format, which is why we're not focusing on it, because we're going to focus on sort of a simplified version. But yeah, so this all has to be written out in there, because otherwise we can't make an executable reliably. Other questions? Yes. So what is text byte zero? By that I mean main starts at this byte, index zero, as opposed to like if we had like some function foo that was defined here, it would start at like this byte. So we have to indicate which, you know, because we could have multiple functions that could be called from elsewhere or other things that could be used from elsewhere in this file. Other questions? So we have this object file here, and we're going to use it to produce an executable. And to produce an executable, well, we're going to need some other object files too, because we need the code for puts at a minimum. So let's say we have our code for all the standard I/O stuff. And as I mentioned, the compiler typically will just implicitly know where this is and link it in. And we'll produce an executable file. And the most important part of the executable file is going to be that data we want to load into memory. And what we're going to put there is we're going to take all our object files, take all the text, the code of them, put them together, take all the data, put them together. And that's going to be what we want loaded into memory. And when we do that, we figure out, oh, this string here, this ended up at a particular location in the executable, and therefore, if I worked from my file, it's going to be at a particular location in here. So I know the memory address that it's going to have. And once I know that, I can fill in these blanks. I can say, okay, this blank here, which corresponds to this entry in the relocations, I know where byte zero of the data segment ended up. I can put that address in there. And similarly, I'm going to look at standard io.o. I'm going to find that it has puts in its symbol table. And I'm going to say, OK, I can fill in the address of puts after knowing where in here it ended up. So questions? This final result here. And so one thing to note about format, so as is alluded to on the slide, so I'm showing you these things in hexadecimal. On a typical, you know, machine that you'll actually use, Well, it's probably not going to be in hexadecimal, because what we want to do is we want to just read the file, copy it into memory, minimal processing. That's the purpose of doing all this in advance, is that loading executable should be really simple. Now, we're going to have some exercises in a couple weeks where you'll do some linking stuff where the formats will be like text that's human readable. That's so you can like manipulate them. But on a sort of real machine, you know, a big concern is making this fast and efficient. So everything's going to be these binary formats, so we can just copy things directly without like converting from hexadecimal and to bytes and back and so on. Questions? Okay, so that. Here's a C file, and let's say we convert it. The exercise is, where do we have the address, memory address that Sahel is located at? Yes, your question?
Wait, just a question before we start the exercise. The lab had that obj dump slash t, is that the symbol table?
Question is obj dump dash t the symbol table? Yes. Other, okay. This exercise, you can talk with your neighbors. So I'm asking, which of these have the memory address in some format, or at least are likely to have the memory address for say hello, and that. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, Okay. So our consensus answer is D. So that's not quite right. So let's start with A. So most people eliminated main.s. So, and the way we can think about that is if I look at the assembly file in a text editor, well, I'm not going to see the memory address of say hello because I never specify that when I write functions in assembly. I never specify, at least typically, I don't specify this function goes at address 1234. I don't write that. I just say, there's a function say hello, put it somewhere. Now, then there's the question of what about the object file? So in the object file, we're going to write out the code for our function, but we don't. The code doesn't include where it's going to be, and where it ends up, well, we don't know yet. And one reason we don't know is, well, we're going to combine it with other things to make our executable, and depending on which version of standard IO.O, that's going to change exactly where it ends up in memory when the executable runs, right? Because we have this code and data from other object files that's mixed in some order that hasn't been chosen when we make the object file. So its actual memory address could vary, so we haven't decided it yet when we make the object file. The object file is just a snippet. We don't know where it's going to go in memory yet, and we could use the same object file to produce two different executables that put place that code in two different places in memory. So the only file which could contain this information is C. So if anything contains it, it's C. Questions? Comments? Yeah. Would there be any other scenario where the memory address for...
like any other method besides...
oh, would be anything with memory address for... so unless you're somehow hard-coding the object files in your assembly, you shouldn't expect them in the object file. Because that decisions about placing things haven't been made. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah. Question, why is it not in the assembly or the object file again? So it's not in the assembly file because when we see our typical assembly files, we refer to functions by their names. We don't specify where they're going to be located. And the object file is a translation of the assembly file. It doesn't make any extra, the assembler, I should say, doesn't make any decisions about where the function's code ends up. It translates it to machine code, but it doesn't decide where that's going to actually be in memory. That hasn't been made yet, and we can't make that until we know what else we need to put in memory around this code. Yes?
So with the mention
of the data, okay, so this slide. So would a mention of the function? So when we call a function, the mention of the call is going to be in our relocations. And when we define a function, the mention of the function is going to be in our symbol table. So say hello, we'll have an entry in that object file, symbol table, and relocations. But the information there is where it is in the file, not where it is in memory, because we haven't decided how it's going to be used in an executable yet. So yes, there will be information about the location of say hello, but that information is not a memory address. Does that answer your question? Yeah. The memory address of so will the memory address of constants like hello world be in the executable file and not the other files? Yeah, the only place it could be is the executable file because you could take the same object file and produce executables with that data in different places. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, what if we were running this program, but the memory was already occupied? Because your complaint is, gosh, you have this memory layout, but how do you run two programs at once if they both want to use, you know, the same place for code and constants? So when we talk much later in the semester about virtual memory, we'll learn that part of that idea I mentioned earlier of the OS, like, setting up this mapping from the addresses the program uses to the real ones, is that different programs have different mappings. So different programs can both use the same address as far as they're concerned, but when it goes to the memory bus, talks to the memory, it's a different address. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes.
Would that mean like each program would have to be recompiled every time, or on every different machine?
The question is, would that mean that each program would need to be recompiled on every different machine? So, because we can assign whatever addresses we want to programs, we just choose that once for a program and we can run it with the same addresses on lots of different machines. So as long as the addresses you've chosen are acceptable to the operating system you're using, it's fine. And typically the only real constraints you'll have are that you better not use this used by OS region. Other questions? Yeah.
Does that mean the .s file and the .o file can be loaded into memory, only the executed?
The question is, does this mean that we can't load a .s or a .o file into memory? Yes, you would need to do some processing on the files to usefully load them into memory. Other questions? Okay. So let's do another exercise. So I'm asking the string hello world, which of these files contain it? And what I'd like to go for as far as containing the literal string is, let's say you opened up each of these files in a text editor and used your text editor's find text feature to look for hello, comma, world. Where would you expect to see it? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, so both B and C, E, K, F? Okay, so I think the best answer is E. So let's start with the simplest case that everyone, I think most people figured out, that it's probably in the assembly file. Now, I could imagine it not being in the assembly file, but we'd expect that the compiler would do something like, you know, dot string hello, comma, world. And that means, well, the assembly file contains that string. Like, it's stored as the bytes that are those ASCII characters in the assembly file. The compiler hypothetically could, like, mess you up by deciding, oh, I'm going to store the string like this in the assembly file. But that would be silly. So it's probably in the assembly file. So how about the object file and the executable? So I'm going to work backwards from the executable. When this program is loaded in memory, we need to pass a pointer to the string hello world, which is going to be stored in memory as ASCII, as a sequence of bytes. And we'd like that to be loaded from our executable file in the simplest possible way. So ideally, we'll just copy bytes from the executable file to bytes in memory and end up with that string in there. So it should be in the executable file in that format because that's the format we wanted in memory. So if we're using the most efficient executable file format, it should be there. Now, I could imagine using some executable file format where we don't do that, but that seems like one we probably wouldn't want to use on a system we want to be fast. So, question?
Wait,
ASCII is like a number, right? So the question is, ASCII is like a number. So yes, ASCII assigns a number for each character. So the question is, why am I saying it's in the assembly when we write it out as a string in our text editor, and I'm not writing it out as a sequence of the ASCII codes? So there's an interpretation here, but if I take the assembly file and look at it as a sequence of bytes, it has that string. And the same is going to be true for the executable file by the same logic. But it indeed doesn't have the ASCII codes written out in the conventional way. Yes? Your question?
So even stores strings that are not in main?
So the question, the executable stores strings that are not in main?
No, so like basically when it goes from the main.c to main.s, it's going to still store that string.
So your question is, does main.s actually have the string even though it's not part of main? And yes, because main.s needs to contain everything that is in main.c. Or else we can't run, we can't use say hello if not, because there's not going to be another assembly file that contains the code for say hello. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Your question? So I didn't get there yet.
Okay.
Your question is, why is it in the object file? I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
Other questions about why it's in the executable file or the assembly file? Yes.
Can you repeat why it's in the executable file?
So it's in the executable file because when we load it into memory, we expect the string to be there. We're going to pass a pointer to put s to a sequence of bytes that are the ASCII codes for h, then e, then l, and so on. And hopefully, our executable format doesn't require us to do some fancy processing to load an executable into memory. We just copy the bytes from the executable file. So, as for the question, is it, yes?
So my understanding is that in the executable file, you have a pointer to like add a memory containing the string, but the way I read the question is like the file itself contains like the string.
So the question is, does the executable just have the pointer to the string? So the executable needs to both have the pointer to the string and the string that it's being pointed to, because we want both to be present when we're running the program. And unless there's something else that's going to set them up, which I didn't write any code to do that, that's not going to happen. Other questions? Okay. So as for the object file, so if you think about how we made the executable file, ideally we'd like to make it by copying bits of the object file and making a few minor substitutions in them. And again, from an efficiency point of view, We'd rather not do like a hexadecimal to byte conversion when we're doing that. So the typical object file format is just going to be a sequence of bytes in the file, so we can copy byte by byte, and then do the relocation substitutions after that. So in the object file, it's most likely also going to be there, because we're not going to do anything to change the string when we go from object file to executable, and we like to avoid that because that's going to be the fastest way to produce executables. We want, when you compile and programs and make an executable, we want that to be as pretty fast. We don't want to waste time taking the standard library code, for example, and converting it from hexadecimal to bytes or something like that. Okay, so that's how I get that I think E is probably the best answer. Yes, I could imagine having an object file or executable format where we store the data in some other way, but that just seems to be giving us extra work for our linker and our OS that loads programs. So questions? Yes. The question is, in the executable in the object file, each character is represented as bytes? Yes, it should be in the same format we wanted in memory. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so what I showed you so far is, you know, this process called linking, where we combine multiple object files, which are ultimately multiple source files converted into some more usable format, into an executable. But what I've shown you so far is static linking, meaning that it's done in advance. When you look at a typical system, often it will do something a little more complicated called dynamic linking. And what dynamic linking means is that rather than doing the linking in advance, we do some of the work when the application is loaded. So typically, we'll do some of the linking work. Some of those relocations will be handled and so on when we make the executable, but we'll leave some for later and do that when we load a program. And as for why we do this, well, if we think of what I showed you with static linking, well, lots of programs use printf, and with what I've shown you, every program's executable is going to have the code for printf in it. And that seems awfully wasteful. If I have like 1,000 executables on my machine and they all use printf, I have 1,000 copies of printf's code, and I'd like to avoid that. And dynamic linking gives us a way to do that where we, when the program's loaded, we also load from a different file the code for printf and do the linking stuff of making it so our calls to printf use that newly loaded code. Now, commonly, dynamic linking works a little differently for just performance reasons than static linking. It doesn't have to, but if you look at like sort of a Linux application, typically it will turn like calls to printf that use dynamic linking will turn into like a function table lookup, so they can have the dynamic linker that runs when we load a program fill in a table rather than replace every single printf call. That's just a performance thing. They could replace every single printf call. It just would be slower. Question? Question is static when it's done before it's loading? Yes. So static means we don't have any extra work to do when we have the executable besides copying it into memory.
And like the machine decides?
The question is who decides what's done? The compiler compiler and linker decide. So, for example, if you're using GCC on the lab machines, the default is dynamically linked, but you can specify the minus static option to make it statically linked. Other questions? So, as I mentioned, dynamic linking, that's usually the default just because we like, say, not using this extra space. Also has the advantage that if, like, we make a bug fix to printf, we only have one place thing to replace, not thousands. And on Linux, you can use the LDD command to see all the things that are linked in programs, and often surprising. So like, this is binls, the program that lists files in a directory. And it uses this list of libraries. The thing on the left-hand side of the arrows is the name of the library. The thing on the right-hand side is the file that was found for it. And the thing in parentheses is where it's going to get loaded into memory when we start ls. So you can see that we use actually a pretty surprising amount of this dynamic linking for libraries. Yes? So the question is, for dynamic linking, the linking occurs at runtime? Yes, so part of the linking occurs at runtime. Yeah, so the part that involves these functions that and other things that are stored in another file. Other questions? Yes, back there. The question is, in dynamic linking, some of the linking steps proceed as in static linking, but for, you said duplicate functions, that's what dynamic linking. So I would say it's for functions that are part of a different file. So hopefully that will get used by multiple files, but it's not necessary, right? You could have a program where you have some of its code in another file, and you're the only one who uses that and still use dynamic linking. Other questions? Question, when I say dynamic linking system when the application is loaded, they mean like run? Yes. So when you start an executable, loading it consists of not just copying from the executable into memory, but also loading these other files and setting up the pointers to those files. Other questions, follow-ups? Okay, so one last thing about linking. When I showed you what relocations look like, I kind of gave the impression, oh, we're just going to write in addresses. And that's not always how machine code works. So as a minor detail, machine code often has the locations of things in memory specified in different formats. So for example, the call instruction that's most commonly used in 64-bit x86, rather than putting the address of the function you're calling, you put how far it is away from your current code. So, like, the machine code would say, call the function that's 4,000 bytes later than this call instruction. And the linker does the same thing we talked about as filling in the address, but rather than filling in the address as is, it computes the difference between the current address where that call function is and the address of the function you're calling and fills that in. And to support this, if you look at a real relocation table, you see a column usually labeled type saying what type of thing does the machine code expect? Does it expect this difference value? Does it expect a normal address or something else? Okay. So that's all I'm going to have on linking. So before I move on to our next topic, questions? The question is it saying that the function address is 4,303 bytes later? It's saying yes. That's that if you take the address of the call instruction and add 4,303, that's where the function is. So that's the format that they've chose for the machine code. And the linker needs to deal with cases where the machine code has chosen something other than just the normal address, like this. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So for our last topic for today, I'm going to talk a bit about some C things. So we're going to be using C for some things. We're going to talk about C code. C has some things that vary between machines. We're going to, for this course, assume 64-bit x86 with these sizes. So chars are going to be 1 byte, shorts 2, ints 4, longs 8. This actually does vary. So there are machines where they'll have different sizes. We're not going to worry about that. We're always going to assume these sizes. And similar, we're going to assume 4 bytes for floats, 8 bytes for doubles. And pointers, we're going to assume are always 8 bytes. And you might find machines where this is not true. This is what we're going to be working with for this course just to keep things consistent. So you're all used to C++, and there's some things that mostly don't come up in C++ that occasionally come up. So one is about Booleans. So C basically doesn't have a Boolean type. There is one. It doesn't work the way you'd expect. And in particular, if you take an expression you'd think would return a Boolean, like say x equals equals 4, it returns an int, not a Boolean. It returns 1 if it's true, and 0 if it's false. And this may have you asking the question, well, what about like negative 1? Is that true or false? So the rule in C is that 0 is false. And that's the only false value. Every other value is true. So 0 is the only false value. Everything else is true. And there's kind of a special case of that. Null pointers are false, but a null pointer is a 0 cast to a pointer. So 0 is the only false value. Everything else is true. Negative 1 is true, and so on. Not that you should necessarily take advantage of this in good code, but that's how C deals without having a Boolean type. So strings in C, I think this should be review. So we have our string hello world. We expect that to be stored in memory as a sequence of bytes, which are the ASCII codes for H, then E, and so on. And when we declare a variable that we think of as a string, it's going to be a pointer to that. It's going to contain the address of that. And in C, we can do pointer arithmetic. So we can take that pointer, and we can say, add numbers to it. So we can go, we have our pointer to hello. We can do hello plus 5 and advance 5 characters in the string. And yeah, we can dereference that and get the data that's there. And this plus 5 just adds to the pointer. Pretty straightforward. And just a special thing we can do with pointers. And you're probably more familiar with accessing parts of strings with the square bracket syntax. And this is exactly the same. In C, it's always the case that doing this value plus value dereferenced is the same as using the square bracket syntax. And this is true in general, not just for strings. And you might say, wait a moment, but I use this with arrays. Arrays aren't pointers, and we'll learn they aren't. Arrays decay into pointers. So when you have an array in C, and you try to use it in a place where a pointer would make sense, it'll become a pointer. And this is one of those cases, because we can add things to pointers. Now, something that might seem like a problem is that I said, OK, hello plus 5, and we just add 5 to the pointer. We add 5 to that address. And if you think of arrays of things that aren't chars, that are more than one byte, it sounds like that might not work. But fortunately, it does. So in this example here, I have a pointer that starts out pointing to numbers, meaning it points to the beginning of the array, numbers of 0. And I add 2 to it. And that makes it advance 1, 2 places to point to the second, or the third element, the element with index 2. And as far as the address manipulation, that means that the compiler is going to generate code that adds 8 to the address, not 2. And the compiler knew how much to add because we declared this as a pointer to an int. Some questions about the scaling? Yes.
For strings, and I guess arrays too, does C remember the length?
We'll get to that later. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is C, is there no null keyword? So in C, you'll commonly see null. This is just a, typically this is a, this is a define for either 0 or 0 cast to a pointer. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So what happens if you have an int array and you try to move just like 2 bytes instead of 4 bytes?
What happens if you have an int array and you try to move
two bytes
instead of 4? So with pointers in C, we can't advance the pointer by 2 bytes. So the only way we could do that is by converting this pointer like to an integer or to a different type of pointer, then doing that arithmetic, then converting back. And as for what would happen, technically it's something known as undefined behavior, so the compiler doesn't need to make it work most of the time. But most likely you'd get whatever the bytes that were in the middle of those two integers interpreted as an integer. You'd reference the point. Yes? The question is there a reason that the implementers of C decided to use integers for booleans and not a byte? My guess is because that early versions of C, you often didn't declare the types of things like function return values, and they defaulted to int, and that's probably why. But yeah, it's most would be just historical reasons, I'm pretty sure. Other questions? So let's do this exercise. So the question is, why can I get a pointer to the array without an ampersand? So there's a special rule for arrays, which is that when we use an array where a pointer is expected, it turns into a pointer to its first element.
Oh.
And this is the special rule that's known as arrays decaying into pointers. Who would like some more time? Okay. Thank you. Okay, so who thinks A? B? C? D? E? Okay, so we have a few for E, but otherwise we have pretty good consensus on the correct answer. So here's how I went through this. So we have our array foo of 4 bytes, the last one of which is the terminating null character. Pointer equals foo makes pointer point to the first element of foo. Then we change that to a B. Then we add 2 to it, which advances by 2 elements. In this case, they're chars. So we have a pointer to the second O. And we assign through that at offset 0. This is, remember, this is the same thing as taking pointer plus 0 and dereferencing it. Pointer plus 0 is the same place. We dereference it. We get a Z. Probably you shouldn't use the square bracket syntax. And similarly, we did foo plus 1, so that's trying to use foo as a pointer, so it turns into a pointer to its first element. We add 1 to that, advance by 1 place to the second element, and then we set that to A. So questions? Yes? If line 7 had 1, would that go to the next slot, to the backslash 0? Yes. Other questions? Okay. So from this sort of example, it might seem like arrays are just the same thing as pointers to their first element. This is not actually true in C. So one way is that you can take an array and assign it to a pointer. You can't do the opposite. That just won't compile. Another way, which I'm mentioning more prominently because this is something that sometimes catches people. If you ask the size of an array, it's an array, it's composed of elements, it gives you the size of all the elements put together. If you ask for the size of a pointer, it's the size of a memory address. And sometimes you might not notice, oh, size of pointer divided by size of it, oh, this is a 2-element array, okay. But no, that's not how it works. If you wanted to know the size of the array you have a pointer to, you better have passed that in some other way. Some questions? So the question is, where is the information of the size stored? So it's part of the type. So just like we can have a pointer to an int or a pointer to a char, we can have an array of size 100, array of size 200. That's something the compiler manages in the same way. So when you type size of array, the compiler remembers, oh, you declared the array with 100. And that's where it's getting that information. Yes? The question is, does that mean the size of a pointer is 8? Question is, always 8 on the systems we care about? It's always 8. It's not 8 on every single system. Other questions? Okay. So one last thing about C. So some languages you've probably used, like Python, you essentially say something works or doesn't work in Python because, I use the Python interpreter and that's what it does. So languages like C are defined in a different way, that someone wrote down what C is, and there's been multiple versions of this. So way back in 1978, Kernighan and Ritchie, who made C, published a book called The C Programming Language, which was sort of a specification saying, this is what C is. It defined the first version of C, which actually looks very, very different from C you're used to. Like, function declarations are completely different. And this was expanded on, so someone else, the American National Standards Institute, decided to write a specification for C, and there were multiple implementations of this. So there was this one document saying, this is what C is, and many different implementations, not like what you're kind of used to with something like Python, where it's like one implementation. So ANSI wrote this version of C in 1989. Sometimes you'll see compiler options referring to -ANSI, that's referring usually to this standard. specifying what C is, and this has been revised a couple times. So in 1999, there was an update which added some features you probably thought were always part of C, like //comments. Yes, they didn't exist before then. It's part of the standard. Some compilers supported them but as an extension, but weren't actually part of the language. Or declaring variables other than just after a curly brace. That was not supported before then. And there's been some updates since then. Now, since the language is defined in this standard, you know, that's what defines what the language is, and we have lots of different compilers that implement it. But the standard has some corner cases that maybe wouldn't be things you think of when you think of a language being implemented. So things we'll call undefined behavior. And here's an example. So here's a function test. So test adds 1 to a number and compares it to the number. We have take it as an int, so assigned 4-byte number on the systems we care about. And I'm going to call this with int max. And if you remember 2's complement in 2150, you might say, oh, so that's going to wrap around to int min. So I'd expect number plus 1 to be int min, which is definitely not greater than int max, so it should print out 0. And if I compile this without optimizations and run it, it's going to print out 0, false. If I use the same compiler, compile this with optimizations, it prints out 1. And you might say, is my compiler broken? Well, let's look at the assembly code. I have an optimized and less optimized. I don't have the fully unoptimized because that's bigger. So the optimized code here, the way it does this computation is it moves 1 into the return value. Doesn't even add 1 to the number. Just moves 1 into the return value. The less optimized version actually does the work of adding 1, using the LEA instruction, doing the compare, checking the sign flag, and so on. So you might say, my compiler with optimizations is broken. And the C standard people have decided, no, it's not. They've decided that you're exceeding the range of signed integers. We don't care what that does. That's what's known as undefined behavior. It's something where the compiler, according to our language specification, we don't say what they have to do. They can do whatever they want. And as you see here, even the same compiler with different options will do different things in different circumstances for that. And the undefined behavior here is signed, integer overflow or underflow. They said the compiler can do whatever they want. They don't need to wrap around, can do whatever. And this kind of makes sense if you think of this from a sort of performance optimization perspective. Almost all the time, when you see number plus 1 being compared to number, it should be true. And you could imagine this arising as in some more, you know, less straightforward case where like the two numbers like come from different places and the compiler would like to generate code that just says, oh, that's always true. But because of the wraparound, you know, if we had to allow that to work, the compiler couldn't like make that shortcut. That whenever it saw a comparison where there might be wraparound, it would have to actually generate code to do the comparison, even if it knows, as long as there's no wraparound, it would happen. So the people making the standard said, well, we don't want compilers to worry about that. We're just going to let them, you know, do whatever they want in this case. And as someone writing programs, this means you better not do signed overflow if you want your program to work reliably. And so this undefined behavior cases where the standard has said compilers can do whatever. It also is what is the behavior of out-of-bounds pointers. If you go out of an array, there's not like a defined thing that's supposed to happen. It's whatever the compiler wants. And typically, it's just whatever's the most convenient code for the compiler to generate. Divide by 0. If you like write to a constant like string, all these things are examples of undefined behavior. And this is sort of a quirky feature of C that sort of gets in the way of our model of C as something where you can look at C code and get the assembly. This is a big way in that how that's not how it works. And there's good reasons why the people who wrote the C standard did this, because, well, you know, as we saw, it allows optimizations, right? It allows us to write code that assumes that we don't have these rare corner cases. And another big reason there's undefined behavior is because different architectures work in different ways, and they just wanted to make it so, you know, we didn't need to worry about what does divide by zero do on this machine versus another machine. We're just going to say it can do whatever you want, rather than requiring compilers to make it behave the same on every single machine. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. I'll be here for questions.